It's a big finish. It's a classic from Rich Mullins, sung for us by Amy Grant. Sing your praise to the Lord. It's 10 minutes after the hour. It is a Tuesday morning. That's the new regular morning for Dr. Don Clark, our resident biochemist, member of the Board of Creation Moments, and an expert on things scientific, at least some things scientific. Aren't you, Don? We call you an expert?
Well, I don't know about an expert, but
you're closer than we are.
I'm gaining knowledge every week.
You have expertise. I don't know how much expertise you have to be an expert.
Now, some of us are, you might say some of us are evolving into smarter people because we're gaining knowledge.
Wait a minute now. That's kind of relative. You could gain all the knowledge in the world and still be a little under the standard set by the previous generation. You know that.
That's right. You can.
I'm going to have to think about that.
Well, it's mathematics, yeah. David.
Is it knowledge or is it wisdom, you see?
Oh,
that's the question.
Now, wisdom would be expertise in the application of knowledge, wouldn't it?
Would you put it would.
Okay.
Yes, So you take knowledge, and if you don't understand it, it's not helpful. So the next step is understanding, and then after you understand it, can you apply it?
Mm-hmm.
So one of my favorite phrases that I stole, I think last year or the year before, is that sometimes wisdom comes with age and sometimes age comes by itself.
And we're a case in point right here, the both of us here.
And here we are.
Dr. Don has come up with an article for us to discuss today, and it has to do with something called codons. That's a new word to me, CODON. And, of course, it all has to do with genetics. And this is a paper by Dr. Jeffrey Tompkins. He's a PhD, and it's available to you over at the Institute of Creation Research website. That's icr.org. And, Don, this is a little bit complex. Can you tell us what a codon is?
Oh, yes. Actually, it's not that complex. I'll break it down I'm sure folks have heard about DNA, and DNA is, of course, the library within our cells, within our cell nucleus, specifically, that codes for every protein that's made not only in your cells, but obviously in your body. So, you can think of DNA as a sequence of letters.
Now, you say codes, that means instructions or information, but who reads that?
Okay, we're getting to that.
Oh, I'm jumping the codon here. I'm sorry.
You're jumping the gun.
You know, one of the things that's occurred to me every once in a while is, why didn't God make it a simpler system? I mean, I guess that wouldn't have as much variability, but
well, here we go to devolution again. To God, it's child's play. Probably Adam knew all this stuff.
Yeah, probably. It would.
Now we look at it, we're overpowered by it. See.
Yeah, here's the thing. I mean, things are getting more complicated as we learn more about the system. So I'll briefly describe, in quote, the system. So you have this DNA, and it's got this letter sequence. Very, very specific letter sequence to it. And our human genome contains only 3 billion DNA base pairs. That is, each single strand of DNA, I mean, obviously I'm oversimplifying it a little bit because our DNA is broken up into chromosomes. But if you stacked all the chromosomes together, you would have a DNA chain that was 3 billion letters long, if you will.
Whoa.
Now, each position in the DNA can have one of four letters. And three of those letters then code for a amino acid, and proteins are made up of amino acids. Amino acids are their building block. And depending on the amino acid sequence, then helps determine what type of protein it is. So whether it's a enzyme, for example, which helps to bring about chemical reactions, or whether it's a structural type of protein, like your keratin, in your hair, or actin, which is actually in your cells. or connective tissue and stuff like that, whether or not it's structural or whether or not it's functional, you know, like an enzyme. Or, you know, gatekeepers for the cells are also everything, pretty much everything in your body is made up of either proteins or either fats or a combination of proteins and fats. We call those lipoproteins or lipoproteins. And then you also have proteins that have sugar molecules hanging off of them. And those have a separate function as well. So your proteins are very important to you because without them, there would be no life and we wouldn't function whatsoever. So the inside the nucleus, you have DNA. And then when the DNA, a certain section of the DNA is turned on, and it says, I need some more enzyme X, for example. I'm just making that up. Mm-hmm. So let's say it the cell says, I need some more enzyme X, I'm running out of it, it's degrading, so I need some more. So it tells, there's a signal that gets passed to through the nucleus of the cell and then gets transmitted to the DNA. In the DNA, then there's another enzyme, if you will, that unwraps the DNA. And that section of the DNA then is copied to a single strand. The DNA is actually a double-stranded molecule, but it gets copied onto a single-stranded molecule called messenger RNA. And then the messenger RNA is escorted outside the nucleus into the ribosomes where protein synthesis actually takes place. So every, like I said, every three letters in, now it's RNA, every three letters in RNA contain the codon. So every three of those codes for a different amino acid. So what this article then is talking about is that there are multiple codons for, let's say, a given amino acid. So an example actually that he referred to is like GGU, GGC, GGA, and GGG. All four of those code for the amino acid glycine. And it was thought, well, this is just redundancy within the codes.
The last letter changing was just redundancy they're talking about.
Yeah, the last one that was changing is just redundant. So
leftovers.
Yeah, kind of leftovers from evolution, and it just worked, and so this is how it is. And if one happens to mutate, it doesn't affect the coding of that particular gene or the coding of that's transmitted to the ribosome. To the messenger RNA. Well, things are a little bit more complicated. Actually, they're quite a bit complicated than that. Because it turns out, the new discovery, that, these sequences tell the ribosomes, that is the enzymes it's kind of like a butterfly that kind of flaps its wings over the messenger RNA to produce these, to add each amino acid sequence. So it's like it opens up, it captures an activated amino acid, it then joins it, it closes up, it joins it to its to the growing peptide or a protein chain, and then it opens it up again, and then the used energy source then gets released along with the transfer RNA.
I'm trying hard to visualize this, and I have this mental picture of lots of little guys with hard hats and tool belts, and some of them are working in like a warehouse, and some of them are working out on a structure outside the warehouse, and in between there are conveyor belts and butterflies.
Yeah, so you got these butterflies that are hard at work in extending the protein chain with new amino acids. And every now and then, they pause. And they pause because they get to one of these codons that not only codes for an amino acid, but it also codes for a pause. And so why does it need to pause? Well, because the growing peptide chain that you're making has to fold. And so it pauses for a certain amount of time so that the growing chain can fold up the way it's supposed to fold. And then it continues working again until it gets to another pause. And then, you know, it does the same thing. And so this goes on and on and on. I mean, literally, you have, you can think of it like a conveyor belt. You can think of it like a manufacturing plant in that, you know, you've got one car representing the protein chain, you know, going, being built. And so you got a bunch of these cars being built on the assembly lines. And, you know, the further you go down, the conveyor belt, the more complete the car becomes. But there are times when you've got to stop the conveyor belt because you got to do more stuff to the car.
You know what this reminds me of is musical notation. If you're reading along a staff in a piece of music, you know, you got these five lines and you've got notes there which represent a frequency, a sound. But every now and then, there's another symbol, which is a rest. It might be a half rest or whole rest or, you know, the different kinds of rest. I can see these three letters with the third one changing, being musical note, rest. Musical note, rest. So it's not unusual in the human mind to have, you would call this like dual coding. It's two streams of information along the same path.
Right. Well, and you do have two bits of information, if you will, or triads of information in these sequences, in these triad nucleotide sequences, though the molecules are called nucleotides. Mm-hmm. And so in the three letters, then, you know, the end letter determines, it might determine how long the pause is, for example, or it might say, just keep making them, keep making them. But it also codes for the amino acid. So it has a dual purpose. And unlike what I said earlier, folks said, well, this is just redundancy, obviously left over from, you know, evolution. It now turns out that we have even more specificity. So we've got codes within a code, if you will. So you've got a code that says, give me a glycine, which is the simplest amino acid. And then you have another code that says, give me a glycine, but I need to pause for a second or two or three. Mm-hmm. Then we can continue, you know, the manufacturing process. So there is absolutely no way to explain this from an evolutionary process. I mean, the more we learn about DNA, the more we learn about this whole protein synthesis process, the more we see how utterly complex it is. And we may have talked about at the previous program what used to be thought as junk DNA. Mm-hmm. That is, long DNA sequences that do not code for proteins. So why are they there? Well, they're there for control. They're there for structural reasons. They're there for a whole slew of other reasons that we didn't understand at the time. And it seems like no matter how far we advance and how much information or knowledge we gain about the cell, we are still thinking like Darwin thought. And let me explain what I mean by that. It's like when he saw a cell, for example, what he saw was this stuff. There was some, because their microscopes obviously were not that good back then or powerful. And so he saw this goo inside the cell, and then you had the nucleus. So that they basically broke down the cell into three major or four major parts. You had the cell wall. You had the protoplasm, which was all this goop, which, you know, you could envision to be like the primordial soup in which we all evolved from. And then you had the nucleus, and of course the nucleus had a cell wall as well. That was about as much structure as that they could see. And because that's all they saw, they said, well, you know, this stuff in the middle there, this protoplasm, is just soup, and it's just a bunch of molecules colliding against each other and those in a random type of way. And out of that randomness comes this order that we call, you know, a cell. Well, then we found out, we got more powerful microscopes, and we said, oh my goodness, you know, the cell is full of structure. I mean, it's got, it actually builds this rope called actin when it gets ready to divide. And the actin then pulls the cell, literally pulls the cell apart into two new cells. And the structure within the cell, these ribosomes, endoplasmic reticulum, are inside tubes, mm-hmm. if you will. And everything is highly directed. I mean, you know, a protein is just not left around to float within the cell, hoping to wind up in the place it's supposed to be, or hoping to be folded the way it's supposed to be folded. There's barrel-shaped proteins, for example, that the finished protein that still needs some massaging goes to and gets completely folded the way it's supposed to be folded. And then there are other proteins that come along and escort that finished protein to the very spot it needs to be used. Mm. How do you explain this? I mean, you can't explain this rationally from just random chance and this happening over thousands of years, millions of years, you know, quadruple millions of years, whatever you want, how much time you want to give it. It just is unexplainable. Hmm. And so that's Dean Kenyon was he still is a professor, but he along with another fellow, wrote a book called Biochemical Disposition. And what the whole book was trying to explain this molecules to man type of process, that molecules, their thought was that molecules were predestined to assemble themselves in a certain way. Well, one of his students challenged him on the concept that, well, how can you get proteins without having DNA first? I mean, that was the only challenge. I mean, that was the only question, and it really wasn't a challenge. It was just a question. How do you get proteins without having DNA? And he thought about it, and he thought about it, and he thought about it. And finally, he had to come to the conclusion, you can't. Mm-hmm. It's impossible that this is so well directed, and everything is, you know, we got tiny molecular machines going on constantly within the cell, that he finally gave up and said, you know what? There is a creator. After all, this is intelligently designed.
Well, I don't know how else to explain that there underlying life itself, there the set of instruction, this information, this intelligence behind it all, that imposes order on what would otherwise be chaos. And where else that I cannot conceive of that happening by accident. One of the great ironies of all of science, I think, and this borders on metaphysics, is that originally the notion was that the smaller you get, the simpler you get. You know, there's a building block called, well, let's call it the atom. That's there's nothing smaller than the atom. It makes up all matter in the universe. And yet when we get down to study the atom and we develop the tools to examine within it, we discover, no, it's much more complex than that. And each level smaller we get, it seems to get more and more complex. That's counterintuitive.
Well, it is, because you know, anything that we build, you know, you build a car, and it's made up of parts, and you can take all the parts apart. I mean, it would take you a while, but you can take a car completely apart if you wanted to, or let's make it a little bit easier. Let's just take apart the engine, and you can have all of the parts scattered around, you know, on your floor. And yes, you can see that, okay, well, I can see this is a bolt, this is a nut, this is I've got the block, I've got these big pieces, I've got the cylinder head, I've got the cylinders, I've got connecting rods, I've got the pins that hold the connecting rods to the cylinders, I've got these little circular things called piston rings, mm-hmm. and you have to force those off in order to take those off, and then so you can look at all of the parts. But the problem in the real world, I mean the real world that God created, is that very thing. The more you look, the more you find, and you couldn't. I mean, it's inconceivable that you could take apart all the different little parts in a cell. And then you just, kind of line them up. Of course, you'd have to do that even if you did it in the computer and you categorized all the little parts in the cell. Mm-hmm. And then even if you could do that, and there's thousands of proteins in the cell, and, they're arranged, like I said, in different very specific ways. And then you take all these thousands of proteins, you take all the other stuff, lipids, the lipid bilayer, you take that apart, and all of the different things that are attached to the lipids, and all the different things that are attached to the proteins, and you take all that stuff apart, all the DNA and the RNA, and then you look at it and you say, okay, now how am I going to put this back together again? Mm-hmm. With an engine, you can put back together because they're solid stuff and you know kind of where the parts go and one fits into the other. But with the insides of a cell, there's no way that you're going to get it back together again, without having an egg and a sperm, mm-hmm. or without having, your original functioning cell to a functioning egg, for example, to start the process.
I've got another question that comes to mind. When is it no longer life? I mean, is DNA alive? Is it living? Or is this the material of which, where does the life part come? When does it enter into the picture?
Well, that's an interesting question because, of course, evolutionists believe that if you got all of the parts, let's say, to a cell and were able to put them back together again the way they're supposed to be put back together again, then the cell would live. Mm-hmm. Would it? This is a really interesting question because if we go back to Genesis, and especially chapter 2, which describes the creation of man, for example. And God he made man out of the dust of the earth, and he molded him literally out of clay, for example. Man didn't become alive until God breathed into his nostrils the breath of life. And, you can ask the question, what is the breath of life? Well, of course, the evolutionists and the atheists would say there is no such thing as the breath of life, and we're just a conglomeration of molecules and electrons flowing from our brains
to
our nervous system
here,
and all this other stuff, and that's what, keeps us alive. But indeed, God breathed into us the breath of life, into our nostrils, splitting the breath of life in literally in two, which could possibly represent our soul and our spirit. The spirit part of us, obviously, allowing us to spiritually communicate with God. The soul part of us being our characteristic. What are we, our mannerisms, if you will, when we laugh, when we, our emotions, our will, those type of things could be classified as our soul. And so when this came into our bodies, then our bodies came to life. And, Adam stood up and God began to communicate with him. That sounds like a fairy tale, but I firmly believe that's exactly what happened. Now, let me jump a couple of chapters in Scripture and get to two individuals called Ananias and Sapphira. Hmm. And you remember, Ananias and Sapphira.
This is in Acts, the early church now.
The early church. They were bringing their funds, their excess funds together for the good of the body. The body of Christ, that is the good of the church. And Ananias and Sapphira had a field. They sold the field, and Ananias came to Peter and laid down some money. And Peter asked him a very simple question, is this what you sold the field for? And Ananias said yes. And Peter said, you didn't lie to me, you lied to the Holy Spirit, and he's now demanding your life. Ananias literally dropped dead right at that moment. That is, the breath of life came out of him, and he died. Now, was his cells completely alive at the time? Was his body completely functional at that time? Well, of course it was. He was alive one second, and then the next second he was dead because the breath of life came out of it. Mm-hmm. So that tells you, of course, you know, Sapphira comes along and says the same thing. And, of course, he lies, and obviously they had schemed it together. And, you know, so she drops down dead, the same thing as her husband's being taken out of the meeting room. And of course it says, you know, great fear came upon the church, as mm-hmm. rightly it should have.
Yeah, get my attention.
It's serious to lie against the Holy Spirit. So anyway, my point is that there is something within us that keeps us, something that is outside of us, outside this natural world that we live in, that is part of God's Spirit that is breathed into us, that gives us, at least humans, the breath of life, and I believe it also gives the animals their life.
Well, how would an evolutionist distinguish then between a human being and a rock? Are we essentially the same?
Well, yeah, they would say that, although they don't verbalize it very often, but their great 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 grandfather was a rock. And so out of the rock, you know, even the crystals, if you will, on the rocks helped to make sure that we only got L amino acids, configuration of the amino acid, instead of amino acids can be in either L form or R form, or a combination of both called a racemic mixture. That's just stereochemistry, you know, that's chemistry 102, if you will. or organic chemistry 101. But, you know, they would say that, well, it was the crystals on the rock that directed the chirality, or, you know, this left-handedness to the amino acids that put us all together. So, in essence, you know, you could say that, well, if that's true, then we came from the rocks, because the water, the primordial soup splashed up upon the rocks and it eventually made these complex molecules, and the rocks helped form everything. So it's quite a story.
It's pretty astounding. And again, the article we're looking at is on the Institute of Creation Research website, icr.org. And when we post this conversation on our website as a podcast, we'll have a link to it there, but you can search it out very quickly. Just Dual Gene Codes, Defy Evolution Again, is the title of the article at icr.org. And Don, you've done a commendable job of making something very complex sound relatively simple. Although I think David and I are still trailing behind you away here.
Yeah. Well, let's go over it again. Okay. So the DNA
can we start again now? Okay. Now what about this rock? Now I've never heard explained with the rocks before, and that's interesting, because if you continue to go back and back and back and back, that's the unfortunate conclusion that you have to come to if you buy this particular logic.
Well, you either come to that, or you come to, well, you know, we came from out of space, and it was the space dust that was on the meteorites that bombarded the Earth from time to time that, you know, brought life to Earth. Well, I mean, that just pushes the problem back a little bit out into outer space. It doesn't solve the problem.
No, it does not.
Yeah, I mean, one of the theories, the continual theories that's trotted out as an undergirding to, you know, the theory of evolution is that these things came about through mutations, or, you know, the lightning bolts or whatever. But it never discusses or avoids the question that a previous mutation would not live. It would not live long enough to procreate and to go on to the next generation. I mean, they've demonstrated that in fruit flies. And that happens over and over and over again. If the mutation is meaningful, or if there's noticeable mutation in a genetic structure, the fly dies.
Well, and that's right. Even if it can procreate and it, you know, it multiplies, you got fruit flies without wings. You've got fruit flies with, you know, one eye. You got fruit flies with don't have any legs. I mean, these fruit flies aren't very functional.
And they'd be delicious, you know, for a predator, but they certainly wouldn't procreate the earth. And they, you know, maybe articles like this are not widely known because I haven't seen the headlines yet. I was watching CBS News this morning and they haven't announced that the mechanism is too complex to have been evolved. It had to be created. Hmm. So the rest of the world hasn't caught up yet.
Well, the rest of the world is asleep. They simply deny or avoid or ignore this kind of evidence. They can't explain it under their theory. Therefore, it must be, you know, ridicule is the first refuge of evolutionists, I think. You know, they look at this kind of thing and they would say they just dismiss it out of hand. It's nonsense. It's bad science. But they don't really deal with the science itself. They don't refute the scientific conclusions. They discredit the scientist.
They give a circular argument, mm-hmm. which is, well, obviously this system evolved, so therefore it had to evolve. Mm-hmm. You're saying, you know, because you exist, you had to exist.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't explain how you came to be in the first place.
It's kind of like saying, I don't have any idea at all as to how this thing happened, which would be refreshing to hear, I think.
Yes,
yeah, well, exactly. You know, I mean, even a statement of somebody saying, I don't know, I have no idea how it came about, mm-hmm. would be a more refreshingly honest statement of trying to describe what's going on than the perpetration of this continuous, very complex fairy tale. Mm.
That's a good way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah, I hate to describe the world as just one more political argument, but you know, the story this morning about Hillary Clinton's, there's a group of supporters of hers that are starting to gear up and are going to get out the real information about the Benghazi hearings. Well, they're ignoring the truth, ignoring the facts that might possibly come out, and they're going to, you know, find out what Jeff Sessions did when he was 12 years old, and suggest all of these ridiculous notions about members of the committee that have nothing to do with trying
what I said about ridicule. It's the first refuge of
actually in Benghazi at the embassy. Mm-hmm. And it is in essence the same thing that evolutionary scientists have continued to say, but look at what Dave did when he was 12.
Mm-hmm.
All the irrelevancies that come up that have nothing to do with the real question.
Well, it has the king of this world, for example, is the author of confusion. Whereas, of course, the king of heaven is the author of order, and not the opposite of confusion, but of truth and order. And so, of course, those following the author of this earth, the king of this earth, are going to want to confuse and to confound so that everything sounds good. but and then make it a personal vendetta against the people actually trying to get to the truth.
Mm-hmm. You discredit the truth teller, sure.
Yeah, to try to discredit them. It's a scheme that's been going on for, you know, years and years, hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that amazes me and, you know, continues to amaze me, has amazed me for most of my life, is how such a small, infinitesimally unseeable object within us can change everything outside of us. And a friend of mine sent me an article on IQ. And the problem, it's an article called IQ and the Problem of Social Adjustment. And among the people between 120 and 140 IQ on most tests, those people function quite well in society. They have good jobs. They go out and get elected to stuff. They become, you know, positive role models in society and all the rest of it. But if you increase the IQ to 145 or 150, and we're talking about 1% of the population, in fact, even less than that. Mm. So first of all, IQ, high IQ is something like 2% of the population, and then 2% of that group. And it's those folks that have a high IQ that end up living under bridges, or you see them working as night watchmen, they are so brilliant, so attuned to to all of the higher level thinking that goes on, and I don't know how that can come out of behavior, or how that can possibly come out of, you know, being born next to an electrical power, or out on the farm somewhere where they got a lot of smells, a lot of earthy smells when they were children. And that has to be the result of the final works of the genetic structure like you're talking about. And it would only possibly come from a creator. It wouldn't be something that these people would die off and procreate first and then die off, and then a couple of zillion years down the line, it'd be another one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's just bizarre. I mean, that's such an incredible, mind-expanding glance at all these little creepy, crawly things that are going on inside of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an amazing creation. We've learned a lot, and we've learned some more today from Dr. Don Clark of Creation Moments, and you might want to pay a visit to their website. It's creationmoments.com. You can link to them from ours at Broken Road Radio. If you're listening there this morning, it's over on the lower right-hand portion of the page, Creation Moments. You click there, it'll take you to a wonderful resource for your church and your small groups and just for yourself personally. There's blogs over there. There's audio available, the Creation Moments program. Of course, you get to hear twice a day with Ian Taylor. And the source is over there at creationmoments.com. You might want to pay them a visit. And Dr. Don, again, and as always, we thank you for joining us today. It's been a delight.
Well, thank you. It's been another fun morning. So I look forward to it for another time.
Well, you did a wonderful job. Codons. And again, that article over at the Institute of Creation Research, icr.org. Don, we'll see you next week.
Okay, very good.
Bye-bye.
See you, Don.
Bye.